Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 33, and I'm your host, Nick Ortigo. A Harvard study says snow days don't subtract from learning. We'll tell you why. We'll also tell you some of the new state laws affecting education. And two major Apple investors want to fight iPhone addiction amongst kids. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, we're speaking with an English teacher that made it her mission to quit taking grading home. So what's her secret? Hey, everybody. Nick Ortigo here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt and education data expert Russ Davis of School Status. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Russ, how's it going up there?
I am back after my small hiatus on the podcast.
Yes, it's good to have you back. You know, it's I think it's been like four shows or so. So
it has been. It's been several. You know, I've just been blowing you guys off, essentially. It's not really, you know.
It's all right.
No, but seriously, it's been super busy, and it got really, usually during the holidays, we like to take some time off and completely disconnect. So that was a part of it, too. So, but I'm super excited to be back on. Lots of fun, exciting stuff going on during the new year.
Yes. Did you guys download the patch? Do y'all know about this? The patch for like that is affecting everyone in the entire world?
The iOS patch, Heartbleed.
Spectre
and Meltdown.
Yeah, there was a new patch issued yesterday. You got to download it, Lissa, because I know you probably haven't.
What is it? I don't even know what you're talking about. What does it do?
There are security flaws that are baked into chips. So chips are basically, they have silicon, you know, and they etch computer programming into that silicon. And so whenever you tell the CPU to do something, it knows how to do it because it's actually physically etched on the silicon. Well, they found a security flaw in how that's handled. And so essentially every computer in the world, and that's not an over-exaggeration,
right,
with the exception of just a few, are vulnerable to programs that aren't supposed to be allowed to can read the memory of another program. So this means when you type your password into your website in Chrome, then another nefarious computer program running on your computer could read that password at the same time without having to do a whole lot of work. And so Intel said they're coming out with a patch tomorrow or this week or sometime. But I don't really, unless they can go and re-etch the silicon that lives in their processors, I don't really understand how they fix it.
But so like Apple released a patch last night or yesterday afternoon.
That's correct. And so the operating system is having to mitigate.
Hey, Nick here. I'm recording this after we recorded this part of the show. I just want you to appreciate just how smart Russ is. Right now he's diving deep into a very technical definition of this potential bug that could affect everybody.
Who's reading what memory. But the problem with that,
if I needed a lifeline for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, it would most definitely be Russ, but he was in rare form when we recorded this, and he went into a very highly technical and long explanation, so I'm going to do us all a favor and just skip ahead.
Segmented to that particular, I know, I've
lost I'm laughing because judging by the look on Lissa's face, she's like, I so wish I never asked.
Slowly dying.
That is the longest question, the longest answer to a 10-word question in human history.
I'm in middle school.
What you need to know
trying
is
to be quiet while my parents are lecturing me.
There's a security vulnerability that exists on chips, and they're going to patch it as best they can, but it's going to make things run up to 30% slower in order to do so.
So download your updates, everybody.
All right. All of that's going to be edited out.
No. We'll save a lot of it in there. It'll be great.
Are you sure?
We'll see. Go ahead.
I can't wait to hear the editing on that one. It's going to be like, hey, Russ, how's it going? Good.
Good.
Next story.
Russ is going to be like me. Russ is going to be like, I'm great.
I'm great. Hard cut.
All right, Lissa, save us all in the teacher's lounge. What do you think?
Oh, goodness. Okay, well, you know, if you've ever been in education or have children that go to school, whenever there's a severe weather situation, mostly I'm talking about snow days, where school has to be canceled because of hazardous weather. But sometimes, depending on where you live, it could be other things like maybe tornadic weather or things like that. But did you know that when we always get to this point of, are we going to cancel school? Are we not? The kids are all talking about it at school saying, there's going to be no school tomorrow because there's supposedly bad weather or there's ice or whatever. Did you know that when principals waffle or administrators back and forth about whether to cancel or not, that it actually is detrimental? Research proves that it's detrimental if they don't cancel.
And this research was done by what university?
Harvard Kennedy.
There you go. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's pretty good. That's a great, but it's not just recent. I mean, it's over a long period of time that they've looked at, you know, different scenarios and data. And so basically what's behind it is, okay, so some schools choose to cancel and some don't. But guess what happens on that day if you're going to still have school? Do you think everybody's going to come? Do you think you're going to have a great attendance on the day that you choose to have school?
When the roads have some ice on them.
So you may still, as an administrator, say, no, we're still going to have school.
Right.
But what happens is you don't have full attendance. So, and then therefore, it really wasn't a built-in day or whatever. Teachers still move on. So kids that were absent, that's a gap. You know, then you're not going to go back and, you know, revisit something that they didn't come to school for, and they may have had their own reasons for not being able to come. And so research says, hey, go ahead and cancel. Go ahead when you're making your school calendar, build in those days, especially if you're in an area that is frequent to some kind of weather disasters or things like that. I know that in the South, we don't really deal with ice, but when we do deal with ice, it shuts us down.
Yeah,
you know,
we have tornadoes and hurricanes.
Right, so we build in weather days for other reasons. And so they're saying to be proactive, go ahead and build those days in and go ahead and cancel. When it's a question, go ahead and cancel because you'd rather move your students as a whole forward than backwards.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think that you're talking about shutting down for, you know, several weeks. That becomes an issue. But if we're just talking about a day here and there, I don't think we should get all up in arms about it.
And I think, I mean, where we live, it really is not across the board. If one cancels, it does not mean that all cancel, and it gets a little tricky, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think what they're saying is go ahead and cancel.
Yeah, I think one of the toughest decisions a school can make is whether to cancel or not. It's a really tough call. There's no worst fear for a superintendent. Obviously the worst case scenario is I don't cancel and, you know, something happens and somebody gets injured on the way to school or something like that. The second worst fear is everyone cancels, and I don't, and my kids get snowed in like happened in Atlanta a few years ago with the snow apocalypse.
Yes. Right.
And the third worst is that, other people, you know, I cancel and then the next day it's sunny and birds are chirping and we expected torrential downpour or snow or something like that. Like,
but who cares if you have that day built in? Oh, well, you know?
Yeah. I just think that often those days are stacked in such a way that they have them built in, but they're not like a for sure thing built in. They're like, if we do this, then we give up this holiday. It's like an either or. So like, you know, I know a lot of schools in the Southeast, at least where I grew up, Mardi Gras is a holiday, right? And it's because no one's going to come to school that day. Just you might as well cake it off because no one's coming. And if they are, they're going to be a little hungover. But there may be folks that are maybe went out the night before and had a good time. You probably don't want them teaching your kids, and so they just call school and say, you know, it's not going to happen. But usually that day or the day after or the day around Easter usually comes from a snow day that we did not take. So whenever you say, okay, this is your Easter day or whatever it was, then people generally, you know, get up in arms. I like the research. I tend to agree with it, that if it's an iffy call, then go ahead and make the call. You get to err on the side of caution, but also it's good from an academic perspective that everybody kind of is on the same page. I think that's what you're getting at, Lissa.
Yes.
You know, it is January now, and January is the month where state legislators are back in session. And Russ, I know you've been tracking what laws possibly could affect schools that are kind of popping up in state legislators all around the country, right?
Sure. I think what's astonishing is no matter like what your political persuasion is, I think every legislature is okay with telling schools on how to do things. It's like this big hot button issue. Like, no matter how small we want government or no matter how large we want government, we can all agree that schools need more rules. And anybody that's listening to this podcast that works in a school is now rolling their eyes. There's an article in the Washington Post that tracks new legislation. And so legislation generally is active either for the budget year, which starts in June or July for most states, sometimes October, or for the fiscal year. For instance, in California, I know we've covered meal shaming. They will now, they're ending meal shaming in California so that, you know, stamping their hands or reprimanding kids in line or things like that, that's all going to come to a stop as of January 1 in the state of California.
The reason this is important is because what happens with these state legislators, a state will make a law, and if it's like meal shaming, it's popular, it makes sense. Other states then kind of domino effect with that same law. They literally will send them the legislation, and they'll almost, you know, swap a few words around.
And if you look carefully, you can see where they've cribbed it, and they've gotten the words wrong. Like, that happens too, that they have, like, people are drafting, and they call it specimen legislation. So test legislation, like they'll give you like, this is what we think the law should look like. And they'll literally do a copy and paste, and you'll see where they get like plurals wrong and things like that, because they're too lazy to read the bill. But I think like food shaming or meal shaming rather, I think we can all get behind that is something that should not happen. Like, that is definitely not the fault of the student. Whenever their parents don't have enough money to pay or refuse to pay.
What's a law that raises some eyebrows?
There's one in Kentucky about student religious expression that is definitely going to get some challenges. The governor of Kentucky, Matt Bevin, has declared 2017 the year of the Bible. And in reaction, they essentially are instilling more protection for student prayer and things like that. What the critics say is that the law gives a legal right to discriminate against LGBTQ students, and you know, because you could have what can be considered hateful speech towards or just religious speech in general towards a specific group or sect, and that is now protected. You can't stop the students from saying that. You can't. Students' prepared remarks cannot be altered before delivery without the student's consent. So I think, you know, student prayer is one of those things that is always going to be there. It's always an issue that people feel very strongly about. And in fact, the Supreme Court has ruled on it several times. But it's not going to stop folks from declaring laws. Mississippi has a law that it's not a K-12 law, but it's Mississippi 1523, which protects any state or local government actor from taking action against a person because they do something because of their sincerely held religious beliefs. So this is often referred to as like the cake law. So if you own a business and you don't want to create a cake for people who are gay or transgender or something like that, then you can refuse service to them, and essentially it stops the government from having any ill repercussions towards them. It's gone through several legal challenges. Regardless if you're for or against it, it certainly doesn't shine a very positive light upon our state. But there it is in black and white. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's their school tax credits, a lot dealing with low-performing schools. School buses,
out of Tennessee with the driver's age.
That's it. Yeah, exactly. School bus drivers must now be 25 in reaction to a 2016 school bus crash that killed six kids. So 24-year-old driver was speeding while talking on their cell phone. I don't know if that student would have been 25, would he not have been speeding? I think that person's an idiot. And I don't think that you would have stopped it.
I think it should be higher than that, to be honest, because Russ, think about you, and you don't have to give too many specifics, but I was like this.
I was not in a place to drive a school bus at 25.
Right.
Let me just tell you that.
I think I've even read this somewhere that like they think males like frontal lobe kind of closes and it like improves their decision-making progress process somewhere around the age of like 27, 28.
62.
Right. Right. Depending on who you are. But, you know, either which way, I feel like in the late 20s, early 30s before really you should be driving a bus full of kids. That's just me.
Yeah, I think they have enough trouble finding school bus drivers as it is, and I think that's why, you know, if you have a Pulse and you're of the legal driving age and you can pass a drug test and have a clear driving record. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it's going to make harder to find bus drivers. In Texas, the famous, like, this law happens over and over and over again, or people, the debate happens over and over and over again. Texas, which is a big state, right? So as Texas goes the rest of the nation when it comes to, like, textbooks mm-hmm. and a lot of things in education. In Texas, school districts buying new school buses have to ensure that they are equipped with shoulder-to-lap seatbelts, which means that other schools buying school buses will probably just see school bus seatbelts as standard equipment from here on out. And there's a big, and this is in reaction to a crash that happened in 2015 in Houston, where tragically a school bus flew off a bypass and several children died. And they feel like, you know, if they would have been wearing seatbelts, then they probably wouldn't have died. And if you've ever seen a crash video of the inside of a bus whenever an accident happens, I mean, it's pretty violent stuff going on. And those seats are padded, but the top of the bus isn't padded if it rolls over.
Right.
So I think it makes sense. It's just been a big debate for a long time.
Well, I think what happens there is now the school has more liability because now you've put seatbelts on the bus. Now the bus driver has to ensure
that they're wearing them. Yeah.
Right. And they might be a 23-year-old who, you know, doesn't want to deal with, hey, are you wearing your seatbelt? Hey, and like you're constantly stopping the bus to make sure everyone's wearing their seatbelt. Yep. So it's
tricky. Nick, you grew up in Virginia?
Right.
So Virginia is the first state to adopt mandatory standards for computer science.
That's good.
It's fantastic. Yeah. I think other states should follow. As somebody that runs an IT company, a software company, I think more kids should have. Now, I don't think you should say every kid's going to be a programmer, but I think every kid should be exposed to it along with other skills and trades. To kind of help them guide. But so many students are just not exposed to coding. And so you really have to show, you really have to take the initiative and show an affinity for it. And I think it's one of the reasons why we don't have as many female coders in the IT profession is because they just aren't exposed to it at a young age. There's no research that states that, you know, women are not as good at computer science. It's just that they're not exposed to it as often.
I've got one for you guys that it's not necessarily a school story, but I just wanted to kind of touch base on it because it affects kids. And it's dealing with Apple, and they have two what they call heavyweight investors. This one was in CNN Money. One is the California State Teachers Retirement System, and the other is JANA Partners. And together they own about $2 billion worth of Apple stock. Well, they posted an open letter basically saying Apple and technology companies in general need to do more about smartphone and screen addiction. And are they taking appropriate steps? Are they putting safeguards within the software to where you can limit that and it's easier for parents to do? And I guess the question that I have that kind of, I think this is interesting, it definitely starts a discussion, but the question I have is, are we kind of looking at screens and the time that kids spend on screens, just like when we were little, when your parents were like, don't stare at the TV too much, you know, it'll melt your brain. are we being kind of old fogies, or is this really an issue that we should be talking about?
It's a real thing.
Yeah.
And it also has social ramifications. So it's not just, you know, the whole staring at the screen, but it's also taking you out of moments and it's, mm-hmm. you know, so you're not even interacting with anyone around you. You know, I get it that sometimes you can be staring at a screen and you're actually learning something, but then sometimes, you know, I think we have to understand that you need to learn how to communicate even with your core group. I mean, yeah. I can't tell you how many children I see that don't even communicate within their own family because right. of screens.
I agree.
They send a text across the house, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I have done that now. Wait now.
Everybody's like,
dinner time. I've been like, Blake, yeah. you didn't close the garage door. Yeah.
So I'm a little biased here because, you know, you don't want to tell people how to raise their kids, right? But the way that we've chosen to raise our daughter is we noticed that it's a little different than some folks in that we severely limit her screen time. Like our daughter, Sloan, doesn't get like uninterrupted time with the television unless we're sitting there right beside her. Maybe we're watching a movie, but she doesn't touch her iPad unless we're in the car for a very long trip. Like if we're just going to the grocery store, that just doesn't happen. And we think it requires, and it's hard for us because if she's in her screen, we're in our screen. So it requires us, you know, to put our phones away. And it requires us to talk to each other, and we think that that's probably a good thing. Not saying that some families are different, and there's I don't think that they're that one is wrong and one is right. I think how you raise your children is your decision. But as far as a personal choice, you know, our child just doesn't have she just doesn't have a lot of screen time. And then I think about like all the bullying and shaming and all that stuff that happens digitally. How you can't a friend of mine said like you just can't get away from it, right? Like you can't like whenever I was young, you could like you could leave school and unless they called your house to harass you, there was really, you know, you weren't going to get harassed away from school. But now like it inundates you. It's on Snapchat, it's on Facebook,
right.
And students pay so much of their persona in their digital presence that you can just never get away from that harassment. And I don't know. I just feel like students, I feel like my kid, my you know, children in general, I think should have less FaceTime than what they do today.
And I mean, everybody, I mean, your opinion with your child is, you know, there's somebody that's going to say, well, that's, you know, I don't feel the same way, so I'm going to, you know, do differently with my child. And everybody's allowed to have their own opinions and do what they want in their house. But I do think if research proves that it's somehow changing responders in the brain and things like that that make you have a sense of euphoria that is false or whatever, you know, then I feel like, yeah, it is part of those companies to help at least just put in some barriers or indicators that just say like, hey, you've been on here such and such amount of time. You might want to go you know, get a glass of water.
Lisa,
you know,
did you ever, download Moment, Lisa?
I'm sorry.
Moment. Did you ever download that app?
I did. Moment? I did. Yeah, I did.
What's your screen time look like?
It's an hour. It's usually around an hour and a half. And honestly, I know. But honestly, bothers me.
I'm at 57 minutes today. It's the morning.
I'm at an hour and 6 minutes today. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. But honestly, I do think that hour and hour and a half is. It's work. Like, it really is work. It's responding to emails.
We need to improve your online social media.
but you know what? And I mean, I probably should. There's two sides of the coin. Like, there's things like what you guys, that just really interesting conversation that we had at the top of the show. I did not know what y'all were talking about at all. But
that was sarcasm.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. But that was because that's probably why. Like, there are a lot of things that come up that I don't know about, that I don't hear about or don't, you know, and it's because, oh, I wasn't on any form of social media or screen. And so I do kind of have this unicorn life where I'm under a rock sometimes.
Hey, are you guys ready for the bright idea?
Yeah.
Sure. We've got a guest. She's actually an avid blogger. She's also pretty active on the education speaking circuit and a published author, somewhat of an expert in blended learning. But the reason we really have her is because she has had this New Year's resolution back in 2017 where she said she is no longer going to take grading home. She's going to do all her assessments in class. What do you think?
So now we're going to see how that worked?
Yep.
I can't wait to see the physics of this.
Yes. Yes. Well, and she's going to share her secret. So stay tuned. Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment is an English teacher in Sonoma County, California, but she's also an avid blogger and has authored several books on blended learning. Recently, Catlin Tucker has been blogging about her 2017 New Year's resolution, and that resolution was to move all assessments into the classroom. Catlin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited that you're here because we are now a year from that 2017 New Year's resolution, which sounds very ambitious. Basically, it sounds like you were saying you were going to move all grading in the classroom and not do it back at home. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
So how did that work out for you?
I have yet to take a stack of grading home, so I have kept my New Year's resolution. And ironically, I'm kind of not a New Year's resolution person. I don't make them for myself personally, but for me, I hit a point where I was like, okay, enough's enough. And it's a resolution that I'm sure many teachers fantasize about. So I figured I would go for it and see what happened.
And I think a lot of teachers probably fantasize about that because they often have to grade at home because they just don't have enough time in the classroom to pull this off. So what was the secret for you?
You know, for me, the decision came from a place of, you know, I love my job, but there are aspects of my job, and I feel like every educator can sympathize with this. There are aspects of our job that we don't like, the aspects of our job that are really draining in terms of our energy level. And for me, over that Christmas break, when I kind of leading up to that New Year's resolution, I was thinking about all the things I love about teaching and all the things I don't like about my job and all the things I find energizing versus the things I find draining. And one of the top issues that I kept butting up against was this idea of I was so resented taking all of that grading and that work home. And I obviously, as you said, I've written several books on blended learning and how to use technology really strategically in the classroom to put students at the center of learning and create a little bit more time and flexibility in terms of what learning looks like and how kids engage with information. And so I figured, why not put my blended learning models to the test and see if I could create time in my classroom and have assessment be something that happened in real time, really as a conversation between me and students, as opposed to something that I put in my bag, either virtually or in paper form, and hauled into my personal life, where it really robbed me of the time that my kids want with me. I have a 9 and a 10-year-old, and they want my attention, and it robbed me of that time and space and ability to kind of relax and be creative that drives a lot of my lesson and project design.
I'm going to kind of put you on the spot because I don't know if you remember what you wrote about a year ago, but you basically had about three reasons. Do you remember what those three reasons were?
No, I don't know the specific reasons.
Okay. You said that your prep time's better spent on designing creative and engaging lessons.
Agreed.
Yeah, two. You said real-time feedback and assessment are way more effective.
Agreed.
So I guess you're saying like actually having that one-on-one with the student rather than, you know, handing them a piece of paper with notes on it, right?
Exactly.
And you said you don't get paid to grade outside of class, which, you know, I think for teachers, it seems maybe like we've you know, just all have kind of accepted that you're supposed to grade out of class, but does it really have to be that way? What's
it? Yeah, first let me say I feel like what I said a year ago was brilliant, and I agree with everything I said. And I do think that often teachers were almost like these martyrs. Like we have a prep period. It is not nearly enough time. I mean, most of us don't even get past, you know, kind of looking at the schedule for the week, figuring out, you know, what administrative meetings we have to go to, what parent meetings we have to go to, what parent correspondence we have to catch up on. I mean, I rarely even get to use my prep period to lesson design, if I'm really honest. I have so many IEPs and 504 and administrative commitments and on campus during those windows of time that I am often robbed of my prep period as an actual slice of time to get ready for my students. And so, you know, a lot of teachers will say, you don't want to like do any work at home. And that's not it. Like I love lesson design. I love creating curriculum. That's what I want to spend my time outside of class doing if I have to do work at home, because I find it really exciting and mentally stimulating and engaging. Grading, I don't find exciting or mentally stimulating. And it's not super rewarding when it's all by myself.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the secret sauce to your ability to do this all comes down to what you call a station rotation model, right?
It's one of the models I use, yes.
Okay.
But I would say I use several different blended learning models to achieve what I'm doing.
Okay, well, let's start with the station rotation model. Kind of explain to the listeners what's that about.
So the station rotation model is a blended learning model that does exactly what the name suggests. There are a series of stations and students rotate through them over the course of a single period, over the course of a couple days. It kind of depends on how much time you have. I have 90 minutes with my kiddos, so I can typically rotate them through 4 20-minute stations or, you know, 3 30-minute stations if I want. I have a lot of teachers who push back and say, well, I teach in a 49-minute period. I can't do what you're talking about, Catlin. And I remind them that, you know, these models are really flexible. So I work with a school district in Palm Springs that is on a 50-minute period, and they do a four-station, two-day rotation. So kids hit two stations one day, two stations the next day. I've worked with schools where they do a four-day, four-station rotation. So the what makes it a blended learning model is that at least one of those stations is an online learning station. Now, if you have a ton of technology, which I actually don't, I'm not in a one-to-one school, then you could have multiple stations be online stations. Typically, I like to rotate it so students go online, offline, online, offline. So they get a nice mix of learning modalities.
So I guess one of those stations is the time where you get the assessment time with the student. Is that correct?
Yes. I affectionately call that station Tucker time. So that's their time with me. It is my teacher-led station.
And is that where essentially the grading's happening and that's kind of what's key?
Yeah, so I use that not just for grading or assessing a finished product, but also when students are writing an essay, or I co-teach English, science, and history, so they might be working on a formal lab report, or they might be analyzing a text. If it's able to be done on Google Docs, so if it's writing where I can jump into a document, or it's a Word doc where, or it's a Google Doc with a text on it that they're digging into and they're making notes about, and I can dive into that doc and work side by side with them virtually, then in that station, I also use, before we get to the actual assessing of their work, I use it as real-time feedback. So instead of what a lot of teachers do, which is, you know, they use class time to present the how-to. This is how you do this type of writing, or this is how you format this part of your lab report. That is all flipped classroom. So I make a series of videos with the how-to for kids, and then my time is spent side-by-side with them in that teacher-led Tucker time station so that I'm diving into documents as they're working, providing real-time feedback. And then as they finish whatever the essay or the project or the piece that they're working on, and it's ready to actually be assessed, then that happens side by side as well, where they literally sit next to me. We have my computer and their Chromebook open, and I'm talking them through the two or three criteria that I'm actually assessing in that formal piece of writing or in that assignment that I'm grading.
All right. So if I'm hearing you right, in the other blended method that you dropped there was flipped classroom. So we've got station rotation model and flipped classroom. Is there something else that you're kind of bringing into there?
Yeah. So oftentimes I will also use, it used to be called the lab rotation. And in my most recent book, Blended Learning in Action, I kind of talked about a more updated version of what used to be a lab rotation, which was where a group of students would rotate between an actual classroom and a computer lab. But now with the kind of ubiquitous nature of devices, a lot of teachers are in a one-to-one or they have access to a Chromebook cart, kids don't need to go to a lab to access devices. They can stay in a single location. And so I use another model called the whole group rotation, where you rotate as an entire group online and offline. So we might start the class offline and then rotate online. And during that online activity, they're all working kind of at their own pace, maybe on activities that are geared to whatever their skill level is. And then I'm plucking them individually during that online component for them to sit next to me at my kind of two-seater table and talk through whatever it is I'm assessing.
All right. So so everyone listening knows Blended Learning in Action actually is a book. It's available on Amazon. It's also in Kindle and paperback. And if you're having trouble keeping up, KatlynTucker.com has, you know, kind of a breakdown of everything we're talking about here, right?
It does, yeah. Okay. There's blogs on everything.
Gotcha. So what do the naysayers say when they hear, you know, you're not grading papers at home? What's usually the first thing you hear?
I think the thing I hear most is I don't have time in class to do that. The teachers that I talk to are usually, you know, lamenting that I have so much curriculum to get through, there's no way I can do what you're suggesting. And I understand that, but I get frustrated because so often the focus is on getting through everything instead of what are kids going to retain, what skills are they developing. Like, if we race through curriculum, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if the kids aren't honing skills that they're going to use long after our class. And a lot of the research on how much actual information kids remember from classes, which is what the teachers are racing through, the percentage of what they remember is so alarmingly low that I really feel like our time as educators is much better spent supporting the development of skills, skills that will be ingrained and kind of follow students after they leave our classes. So I think we spend time on what we value. I also think that there aren't a lot of credential programs right now that are focusing on how to support teachers in learning about what are the different models? When would I use a station rotation and what would that look like? And when would I use flipped classroom and what would that look like? And so teachers don't know how to move away from this whole group, one size kind of fits all lesson to create the pockets of space and time needed to have these conversations. And whenever I go out and I train or I speak at conferences, I tell teachers, I'm like, think about what you love about your job and find time to do more of it and figure out what do you want kids to really be able to do when they leave your class. And I bet when they get to the bottom of that answer, it's not going to be about the information, it's going to be about skills. And so how are we acting as coaches facilitating the development of skills?
Excellent. Well, again, it's CatelynTucker.com. And do you have a resolution for 2018 that's as aggressive as last year's?
You know, it's funny. I was just thinking about what I wanted to blog about going into the new year. And it wasn't so much a resolution for me. It was more of a, hey, it's almost in line with what we're talking about here, Nick, which is like, before you dive into a second semester, think about the parts of your job that you love and why, your why. Why are you in the classroom? Articulate that for yourself so that you don't lose sight of it in the mundane day-to-day stuff that is often so draining and kind of disillusions teachers.
Yeah, that sounds great. I know it's Simon Sinek, who's a big motivational speaker.
I love him. Yeah,
He's great. And he has this big theory when it comes to marketing. It's like, it's not what you do, it's why you do it. And it really should be applied to everyone, probably on an individual level, just when it comes to their work. So good stuff. Well, again, we really appreciate your time. Are you ready for our pop quiz?
Maybe. Okay. We'll see.
All right. First question. If students could go to school for only one subject, which subject should it be?
Oh my gosh, that's a mean question.
Oh yeah, so it's just a what if.
A what if. God, see, selfishly I want to say English because I want them to read and write, but the math teachers will all hate me. But I'm going to say English.
Okay, that's a fair answer. I mean, you know, you got to be able to read to do math, I guess. What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
Soft skills.
What do you mean by that?
I just don't think that there's a real focus on teaching kids how to communicate, how to collaborate and work together effectively. I hear from students all the time, I hate projects, I hate group work, they don't, nobody contributes. And I'm like, you guys don't have the skills needed to have, to have conversations, to create things together. I just think so often we're focused on the more academic skills and we really kind of neglect this whole other set of soft skills that, you know, if you read anything coming out of Forbes or the skills that most employers are saying kids leaving high school and college right now don't have.
And I don't think we've said yet, the age group that you typically work with is 8th, 9th grade?
9th and 10th grade.
Okay. What does every child deserve?
I think every child deserves a creative kind of space and environment where they have autonomy and can learn.
What's the biggest challenge for today's educators?
Mass. I think, honestly, every great idea that's coming out of education is just hard to do because there's so many students and not enough resources.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
Autonomy.
Which teacher changed your life?
Miss Lowney.
Why is that?
I don't remember a lot of my teachers in high school. I had a lot of competing priorities, but I wasn't a big reader until 11th grade. And then I was in Miss Lowney's English class and she made me read A Prayer for Owen Meany, which looked like as thick as the Bible. And that book is what made me a reader. And I ultimately believe put me on a course to enter education.
All right. Good stuff. And last question, pen or pencil?
Pen. Pencil's so smudgy, it hurts my eyes.
All right. Again, the website is CatelynTucker.com if you'd like to keep up with everything we've been talking about today. And her book, which is Blended Learning in Action, A Practical Guide Toward Sustainable Change, is available on Amazon.com. We really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Nick.
All right. Take care.
That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and subscribe to the show. We'd also love it if you leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismissed. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortigo, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed.